the bigger focus is on shotguns. It's really very interesting that shotguns are being staged here because most of them have been torn down in Fort St. Joe. So I'm going to talk briefly about that and how that ties in with the Fort St. Joe community. And then from there, I'll tie it in these interviews. There's clips from, I interviewed maybe about 12 people from various generations, the oldest being 101 years old. That would be Miss Cleo Bess. Unfortunately, 2 days after my interview with her, she ended up in the hospital and ended up passing away. But she was just full of energy, full of wisdom, so it was a blessing to be able to capture her story. And it goes all the way down the line to Generation Z, which is like, you know, your little 12-year-olds. And so it's really interesting to hear the history and story told of Fort St. Joe through these various eyes across the generations. And you'll hear how, you know, in the very beginning, a lot is more so focused on, there is a lot focused on race. That's just kind of what it was with Miss Cleo growing up. And then it gets all the way down to my cousin Precious, who's 12 and biracial, and race is not mentioned at all, you know? So it's really interesting with the dynamics of how things kind of change over time, or the focus of certain things change over time. So I hope you enjoy it. I will start with the shotgun house thing though. So my parents are high school sweethearts from Fort St. Joe. My dad's actually originally from Hartford, Alabama. That's another story because he'll start talking about his theme of Sweet Home Alabama is like his favorite song. But he was adopted into the Fort St. Joe culture and he embraced it. My mother grew up in shotgun houses. I can't think of, her family moved around a lot. It was, she had her mother and her dad and her four siblings lived in like a three, what I guess you would consider it like a three bedroom kind of house, but the three girls stayed in one room and the two boys stayed in another, and that's just kind of how it was. And I was talking with someone earlier today and even just now recently about what shotguns meant back in the day to people. It wasn't this hip, cool thing that you see on HGTV now. It was, you know, it was like, they were called shacks informally. And my mom explained to me that they were shotguns because, you know, someone took a shotgun and shot, you can hit pretty much every room in the house. But they were also very intimate spaces that people were just very happy to have a roof over their heads. In the art gallery at the last exhibit, there was actually a picture of my mom's great grandmother's shotgun house. Her name is Grandmother Tucker. She was a former slave. And so, of course, coming from slavery where the conditions were unimaginable to actually having a roof over her own head as a female, as a woman, was a huge deal. She wasn't the nicest person, understandably, but everything from the 1800s, you know, she retained from the way that she dressed. I asked my mom what does she look like, because my mom spent a lot of time with her. My mom said that if you see any picture of Harriet Tubman, like, no joke, that's pretty much what she looked like. Hair tie, even the features, and down to her, what she called her slave shoes that she used when she was working in the cotton fields. And so she retained all that, but the shotgun house meant the world to her. That was property, that was ownership, you know? And unfortunately, value, I mean, there's just it can be politics, it can be a lot of things that were involved, but most of our shotgun houses were just looked down upon. No one saw value in them, you know. As the economy started getting better and there was more opportunities for both races, and we had gotten into the integration, integrated space of things, people were like, no, I want an all-brick home. I want the white picket fence. So with those kind of things being considered, a lot of our shotgun houses were torn down. Mr. Monette, who was pretty much the historian of North Fort St. Joe, he actually told me a story. I do remember when I was in Fort St. Joe and I would go visit the Main Street, also known as MLK, was lined up with shotgun houses. And that was kind of like my initial exposure to them. I thought they looked quite unique. They were falling apart at the time because no one was staying in them. Squatters were using them, they were just kind of there. So I believe a church on Mexico Beach actually took like four of them and used them, you know, renovate them and use them in that way. So that's the history of the whole shotgun house thing. For me, I've never personally actually lived in one, but I definitely listened to all my mom's stories, and I realized, you know, if I was telling someone downstairs, actually Nancy made like a replica of like a shotgun house that was recently torn down. I was like, where were you like 30 years ago or so? Because, you know, my mom could have had like a replica of any of her childhood homes, or even, you know, my, you know, great granddaughter to the 16th power had like a replica of her home. We would love to have had that, you know, in our family and on our table. So, you know, thanks to HGTV and, you know, for making it hip, and thanks to people of this project for renovating them and bringing them back to life. I'm still learning more and more about the process, but I think it's an awesome thing. And so now we're gonna dive into Port St. Joe. So I actually went to Port St. Joe Elementary School when I was in third grade and sixth grade. So I all my childhood friends, my best friend and I, she ended up being my best friend, who were actually christened on the same day as baby, so I have a lot of history there. But one thing that I did realize when I went to Port St. Joe, because I was coming from Tampa, where I was usually the only person that looked like myself in the classroom, I was like, you know, there were these railroad tracks, and there was one group of people living on one side and one group of people living on the other, and I just didn't understand that. And I remember there was a beach called Money Bio Beach. There were pictures of that in the other gallery, and that was the, what they called the black-owned beach. Well, what I was telling people when they would come visit, somebody was like, well, why did they have their own, you know, why did they want to be separate? I was like, please understand, they did not want to be separated. They just kind of had no choice, you know? And so they were given this, you know, little plot of a beach, because you think about how big Miami Bayou is. I don't know if you guys have been there, but it's like in between the Cape and Indian Pass, so it's not that huge. And compare that to like Port St. Joe Beach, Beach, places where people of color were not allowed. We had this small little space and we cherished it. And so a lot of, you know, black business owners bought land and they turned that into like a little vacay place, a safe haven. Well, it was like in the mid 90s when I went there as a kid, and that beach still existed. My first thought was, because kids are just so blatantly honest, I was like, Dad, why are there all these black people here? Like, I was there for one of my classmates' birthday parties or something, and he explained to me the history of Money Bayou Beach, and I was like, wow, like, this is so weird. It's like mid-90s, and I feel like I'm in the, like, 1950s. And that also translated over when I was, you know, going to class there. I had some friends that lived in White City, and unfortunately, I, like I said, mid-90s now, was not allowed, it was not highly advised that I go over there to visit them and play with them. And it wasn't because their parents didn't want me, but it just so happened to be that my friend lived right next door to someone who was either involved in the KKK or skinheads, and he made it known, he got paraphernalia all over his house, and they did not want to be responsible for, you know, a little child turning up missing somewhere. That it was a unique experience being in Port St. Joe, but not one that I would want to relive, but because of that, I can kind of understand some of these stories that are told by older generations. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm at the older end of the millennial generation kind of category, but I'm not, like, oblivious to everything that's happened, because some of it actually kind of, some similar experiences happened to me, and it's just like, you know, 90s, 2000s, you know, just kind of, it's kind of interesting how that is. So I'm gonna jump right into it. This is, I took a clip from Cleo Best. Now, I'll remind you, she's 101 years old, so you may not be able to understand everything that she's saying, because I was actually sitting right next to her, but I'll just like kind of translate what she's saying, and she'll tell you a little bit of her story. She actually, ironically, ended up in Port St. Joe. She's from South Georgia. Ended up in Port St. Joe because her husband...
Can't do that.
I'm so sorry.
All right, you gotta wait
okay.
for it.
Okay.
You're gonna have to improvise. You're gonna have to wait for it to reboot up.
That's fine.
It takes about 5 minutes.
Well, you're okay. Okay. Are there any questions for me before I back in the day when people actually wrote letters and not like sent emails and text messages to people, he lost his job, and so they need to relocate, and he actually could not read or write, so she wrote the letter for him to his family in Appalachia, and they told him about Fort St. Joe, and that's how they ended up in Fort St. Joe. So there you go, there's some Apalachicola tie there. So,
Demetrius, could you tell us a little bit about the Pierce family? I was talking to some ladies that were here for the talk last weekend.
Yeah.
And we were talking about Muddy Bayou, and they were talking about the Peters that they knew because they lived here, but they lived in Muddy Bayou.
Yeah, so the Peters family, last names kind of mean everything. You can call them clans, I mean, whatever, but that's how people are grouped. And so the Peters, the Dressbacks, which is my best friend who I was Christian with, is a Dressback, Stalwarts, and believe it or not, actually my mom's grandfather, who was a gardener, they owned businesses throughout Fort St. Joe. And the Peters family owned both of them. And so, yes, the Peters, the third person that I interviewed is Jean Kareen Peters. She's actually an immigrant from Cuba, her family is. But they, the Peters and all these wealthy black families bought land on Muddy Bayou. And the Peters had like a huge influence just because they had a lot of money, so they could buy a lot of things, they can interact with more people and get involved with, you know, people of like maybe different spaces that other people couldn't. As of right now, we do have the Washington High Museum, which is whatever is like the remnants of the original school on North Port St. Joe that was around prior to immigration. And we have turned some of that into a museum. And Mr. Nathan Peters is over that museum. So I would definitely go check that out if you're ever in the Port St. Joe area. Also, they have a restaurant / it's kind of like a boarding house back in the day that they have renovated. And they're in the process of reopening. And that is probably one of the last remaining original black-owned businesses in Fort St. Joe. And it's really cool because actually in the museum, you saw like how it looked in the very beginning and the different changes that have taken place over the years, and it's still standing. The other thing that the Peters owned was a motel because, you know, it just wasn't, there was a lot more that people hadn't taken into consideration back then, people of color, you know, traveling and that kind of stuff. I mean, I could just go to any hotel and get a room with no problem, but, you know, that wasn't the case. So they knew that there were people coming through. There was a lot of people. They called them, my mom called them boat people, or people that come from the islands, like Miss Kareen, who ended up becoming a Peters. But they would come through and work. You know, sometimes people would maybe refer to them as migrant workers. And they needed a place to stay because even though they were foreign, they were still of color, so they couldn't stay on the other side of town. So the motel was actually named after Miss Kareen Peters' daughter's Linen Bay, so it's the Linen Bay Motel. So it's really cool how these people took, you know, something that was obviously like, talk about turning their lemons into lemonade, literally, but not because they necessarily wanted to most of the time, but because they had no choice. You know, it's kind of like survival purposes. So that's the Peter story, and you'll get to hear more of the Peter story in a few minutes. And the person, I'm going to give you an overview of the upcoming people. The person that comes after Miss Bess is Mr. Willie McNair. He is actually now the oldest living individual in Fort St. Joe. He's 99 years old. And a very witty, bright, older gentleman. He had 5 children, and he wanted all 5 of them to go to school. And he has failed to forgive the 3 or the 2 that did not go to school. So as I was actually interviewing him, I had to kind of cut off our interview. because his son was sitting right next to me, and he was just like, letting him have it. He was like, yeah. Oh, because he asked him, he's like, well, did you go to school? And I was like, yes, sir. I was like, I went to college, and my master's, and I had like half of my doctorate done. And he was like, well, let me tell you about my kid. Exactly. He was like, I personally made a trip all the way to Tallahassee and went to the school. And he's like, but no, he wanted to fall in love, and he liked girls. And then he was like, with his other girl, no, she wanted to fall in love and get married. And it was just like, oh, wow. They're used to him, but he was hilarious. But his story is interesting because he's actually from California, and his dad was white, and so things were very different in California. You know, he could live there with no problem, and he was talking about how his grandfather was sick, and they, you know, came over to Florida to go visit him, and they were traveling together, and his dad went inside the store, and he stayed outside, and he was playing alone outside, because it was safer those days, it didn't really matter, but unfortunately, it was not safe if you had a child of color playing outside of the store. And he was saying how, you know, there are these grown men that came around, they were just harassing him, giving him a hard time, and his dad came outside the store and, you know, obviously took up for his own son. And they were like, well, why do you care about this, you know, Negro kid? Like, why are you even, like, worried? He was like, that's my son, you know. And so he said, you know, he was obviously a daddy's boy, and he said it got to the point where, you know, his dad was a businessman, and he was also a person that owned the business in Port St. Joe, but it got to the point where he did not want to travel with his dad because he was just tired of being harassed. So that was a very interesting, because I never really thought about what it was like for a biracial kid living with the other parent, you know, because in my mom's grandmother's case, my grandmother Ethel is biracial, and both of her parents kind of abandoned her because it just wasn't popular, but she stayed with the family that was black, so even though she kind of stood out like a sore thumb from them, it wasn't as bad as Mr. McNair's case, you know. She still was, ironically, she never saw her mom again, but she remained very much connected to her dad, Pensacola, her white father, and would go visit him, but it wasn't like they all lived together. So that was interesting, and Seth McNair. And then the next person we go from there to segregation, and then you end up talking about the baby boomers who were involved in integration. And so Deborah Stallworth, who is like a, you know, very influential educator in Port St. Joe, she's part of the first class to integrate Port St. Joe High School. And very bright person, and she would have been the first black female inducted into the Honor Society. And she'll tell her story, and she'll mention the fact that she was really hurt because she didn't get accepted. Well, being an educator, she ended up coming across the files like 20 or 30 years later of the documents of her application, and she saw where they took a vote, and it said in the bylaws that they would never allow a person of color to be in the Honor Society. Now, I mean, she went on and went to college, and she's part of like every Honor Society that you can probably think of. She's really bright, and she made sure that her children had the opportunity. But that was, you know, that was really interesting to me because, I mean, I grew up and I was in a lot of gifted classes and took AP classes, and I am a part of a couple of honor societies, and I just, you know, it's like I said, it's just things that you just don't really think about that start having more of an impact when you talk to people who've actually lived during a different time period and survived and, you know, can kind of tell their story. So that's that.
Excuse me, would you please tell me where north of Port St. Joe is?
Sure, yeah, so if you're coming from Port St. Joe Beach, across the bridge where Paper Mill used to be, when you look over the bridge, that is all north Port St. Joe. The first thing, they put like the Super Dollar store in front of it. That wasn't there when I was a kid. So, yeah, so been serving Peace Corps for 2 years, okay? She's in Micronesia. And when she first got there, she called my mom, and she was just, like, devastated. And she's like, you know what? Some of these same homes that people are living in third world countries, I've seen in Port St. Joe and elsewhere, because my sister's traveled a lot. And she's like, it's just really sad. I mean, yeah, I think it's good that we're helping third world countries. She's like, we need to, but why do we have people living in third world conditions in the U.S.? And it's like, I mean, I've seen those houses millions of times, and, you know, of course, my neighborhood in outside of Tampa and Valrico looked nothing like the homes there, but I just figured that's just what it was. You know, I never really questioned it as much. But when my sister brought that to my attention, I was like, oh, wow, you know, I went back and ran through the neighborhood, and I mean, there really are some people living in dirt bowl conditions. I found out that some people don't even have heat and air in their houses, and, you know, and it's not because they're lazy and they want to. I mean, there are people working 3 jobs just to get by, but Florida is a very expensive place to live, and when the paper mill went down, that ruined a lot of people's, like, you know, financial, like, situations, money that they had planned to maybe use to invest or pass down to their kids. They had to try to stretch to survive. So that's another thing. But yeah, that's North Port St. Joe. It goes from there, and then if you ever go to Weewaw, there's like a back road that runs to Weewaw, and that's the back, because I'm like horrible with directions. I don't know if I'd be east or west, but it's the other part of North Port St. Joe, which is interesting because back in the day, the closer you were to the 8th Main Street, the better things were, because that was like the business district, right? That's where all the business owners stayed. As time progressed, and I didn't include this clip, but Mrs. Peters mentions it, with integration, it actually hurt a lot of black businesses because there was no need for them. You know, like, I was like, okay, I can shop at the local store. I don't have to shop at a store here just because of the color of my skin. But also, like, a lot of money left the community. A lot of that community kind of village, takes a village to raise a child kind of mentality kind of left. So that also contributed to, you know, the what you see now as far as the world living conditions here. But anyway, so there was another set of railroad tracks within North Port St. Joe, I'm like, okay, so then it becomes a class thing. You go from separating people by race and ethnicity, and then you separate by class. And so the further back you go towards Weewaw, that is the side where people had a little bit more money. I mean, there are people who had money that stayed, who still kept their houses by the business district, but people who want to, you know, build new houses, they built back there. And so you will see, you know, all these, you know, four-sided brick homes. You'll see these new apartments that they just built that are just really, really nice. They remind me of something that I've seen from Atlanta, and, you know, and then on the other side is Bridgeport, which is, like, for, like, you know, newer, younger families, and, you know, all these, it's really interesting to me how there's a class thing, too, because when the apartments were being built, there were some concerns, you know, they're like, oh, are the people from the other side of the tracks gonna come over? And I'm like, what do you mean the other side? They're like, you know, the ones closer to Main Street. I'm like, what? That's how North Port St. Joe. Hey, what are you talking about? Like, some of those people you're talking about are, like, your relatives. It's like your first cousin on the street that you're talking about. Like, you're kind of looking down on them, so. I don't know. It's interesting how people, you know, will allow society or whatever to use little minor things to separate when at the end of the day we're all human beings. And but, yeah, so that's if you ever do go to Port St. Joe, I suggest you kind of go and not look at it and gaze at it like it's like a museum. I mean, because there's still people. I mean, but, like, just kind of, it'll kind of open your eyes and just kind of see how much they've come far, but they can still come further and progress further when it comes to finances and race relations. But how's it looking?
Sure, we can go whenever you're ready.
Yeah, we can rock and roll, you guys. Don't worry, I'm pretty outgoing. I feel like I can talk forever, so. All right, so here's Miss Cleo Best's story. And like I said, if you can't really understand it, that's okay, don't feel bad. I'll just tell you what she said. And they couldn't even sit in the front seat. So they had to ride in the back, the dogs could ride up front. so you weren't even considered human. But I mean, you know, back in the Constitution somewhere, you know, only black men were three-fourths human, so black women were never considered human in the first place a long time ago. So it's not surprising to me now that I know history. But anyway, so she was just like, that was the last straw. She was not going to pick up the feces of the dog that they just let loose because, and so she quit. But had that been my great-grandmother, she probably would not have quit. She would have done what she was supposed to do. So you saw a little bit more fight come along as generations, you know, progress. So, Mr. McNair.
So they were all there.
Somewhere down the line, I'm not not related to him personally, but I am related to his grandson, which is, you'll see, like, later, his name is Keanu Nair, which is just weird. And he just related to everyone in the small town, so. I was like, I will never, ever date anyone from Port St. Joe, but I do have an interesting story about my boyfriend I'll share later with genetics and stuff. I'll share that later. Okay.
So, okay. She been through?
Yeah, but she didn't do much of it when we were growing up. But after we were older and out of college, she had a favorite dish. It was raw capoeira.
I think one thing I observed with Mom's family is my grandmother was sort of international in her approach to life. So Thanksgiving and Christmas, find people from any nationality or country at the table. We got exposed to that. Mommy's the same way. You know, when we were growing up here, she would invite people to dinner at her grandparents' next door or here or upstairs in the store. Yeah. And it didn't matter. Background is just comfy.
And
my grandmother used to tell all the stories.
Oh,
that's
nice.
Especially grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
She told
much.
She told a lot of
times. So there's part of the clip I forgot to include. So she was saying Mrs. Peters, Miss Kareen, Jean Kareen is actually her maiden name. And so her family came over from Cuba when they were like, well, her dad came over from Cuba when we were like teenagers. Of course, in search of a better life. So I asked her, I was like, oh, that's so cool. So, you know, they're black Cubans. I was like, well, did you guys speak Spanish? And yeah, I kind of knew the answer, but I just wanted to hear it from her. And she's like, no. She's like, my mom spoke it. But, you know, being a person of, you know, you're a person of color, even though she was born, Miss Jean was born in New Jersey, I mean, there were still some biases and prejudice and racism going on north, believe it or not. So she was like, it was better to just be black and foreign, if that makes sense. And so her family also really pushed for them to get education. What was interesting, though, because they saw education as their way, you know, way out and living better. And what was interesting is that her father did not want the girls to go to school. Education was only for the guys. And so the guys typically got scholarships and kind of paid their way, but, you know, the girls were not allowed to go. And so further down the line, if a female wanted to go to college, her daughter or a granddaughter wanted to go to college, and they had to they had to work. There were no scholarships that they, you know, their parents just didn't see that. It didn't make sense for a woman to be in school. It wasn't their place. So ironically, I'm sure her grandfather and her dad were, you know, probably turning in their graves when Miss Peters, we actually went to the same college. We both went to Fisk University. So she went to Fisk and was a math major, chemistry, double major, chemistry and math. Definitely areas that women weren't allowed into. And I thought it was really good to include her story. The first thing is that people kind of see Northport, St. Joe, they just kind of put a blanket over the entire population. So when I was sitting there at the art gallery telling some people, I was like, hey, you know, not only do we have like educators and people of various degrees, but we have immigrants. You know, we have like people who, you know, have really diverse backgrounds as far as ethnicity is concerned, and people didn't know that. And I mean, that's understanding, you know, but I want to reveal some of these stories. But Ms. Peters was saying how, as a family, coming from a family of immigrants, and then coming from up north and making her way down south, because Nashville, Tennessee is where Fisk University is, and there was a lot of civil rights actions going on. Because Fisk University is where Congressman John Lewis went. You know, the guy who always talks about getting hit in the head when he was like, you know, like 18 or 19, participating in civil rights. Yeah, he was in Nashville when a lot of things happened to him. And so Ms. Peters was just kind of thrown right into the heat of the civil rights movement, and how, you know, she's talking about how she had to walk everywhere. That was new to her. I mean, in New Jersey, she didn't have that problem. She wasn't allowed to go in and try on clothes in the store. And even when she came down here to Florida because Nathan Peters, her husband, went to Morehouse in Atlanta, and so they met like on a college weekend, you know, like. And ironically, Miss Peters got married and had her first child while she was still in still in school. So married, they went home to Florida. She had to do her last year away from college. I mean, you know, like kind of like I mean, I guess she just did her paperwork and submitted it up there. But very just awesome. She said she actually ended up giving birth on her day of graduation. So I guess she didn't walk across the stage. That was her graduation present, was Lynn Peters. But she said her big thing was bringing educational opportunities to the North Port St. Joe community. I mean, that's the only place that she could teach anyway. But she noticed that, you know, education was behind, you know, not even just on the whole, like, race level, but even just North versus South, geographical kind of level. And she wanted the kids to get exposed to things so that they can have the opportunities that she and her daughters had. But she ended up sending her daughters to boarding school because the environment was just, she still segregated and she didn't want that environment for her kids. But her daughter was saying, who was also included in an interview, was saying how they went to some store in Panama City and got in trouble for trying on clothes. So even her daughters experienced that, and I think that's pretty much when she was like, okay, boarding school, off you go up north. I don't want you guys to have this. But it's really cool because this is actually her great-grandmother from Cuba that's being displayed there. And so, yeah, it's really cool if you actually get to look at the whole documentary, because you'll see childhood pictures of these people as they're talking. Nobody wants to be filmed. There's a couple reasons I'll give you later for that. But they did provide pictures, and it's really cool to kind of look at the evenings. It's like something from a museum, right? Like a painting. It's really cool. All right, so next up, I believe, Deborah Stalwart.
Yeah. 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 It's hard to talk about anything. I heard this in college history that I tried to put away.
Yeah.
But not everybody was like that, I have to say. I hate to say this, but I had the grade point average and everything, but I was not allowed membership into the National Honor Society. Then once I became an educator and a sponsor of the National Honor Society, I found the minutes where they voted not to allow blacks into the I should care. But at that, you know, at that point, I had to put on that hand. And
so there's Ms. Deborah telling her story. I mean, she's an educator now. She is actually was over gifted. She worked with gifted kids throughout her career and kids who had what they would say, you know, developmental challenges or delays, autistic kids, and special education. There's so many different names out for kids with different learning styles. But you know, that was her one of the main reasons why she went into that field. Education. She wanted to make sure that not only that people who were gifted actually got to be able to have opportunities to be acknowledged as such, but those who were looked down upon as being challenged also had opportunities to succeed as well, because you know, some of her opportunities were cut short just because of the color of her skin. And she actually, I mean, she's a very soft-spoken woman, but I plan to be a future psychiatrist, and I did take a psychiatry course before I got sick in school, but she would definitely have, she has the symptoms and circumstances to be considered to have PTSD from the situation. I mean, it was very, and she was just a kid. I mean, she had to be like 12 or 13, 14 years old when she had to go over there, and, you know, it was like a bittersweet thing because with the black school, you know, resources were limited, but it was very much like a family, knit family kind of thing. All of your teachers were coming from like historically black colleges, and FAM was, you know, even though Ms. Peters came from FIS, which is where I went, FAMU was the closest school. And so kids were being inspired. That's why you have a huge population over there. They did go to school, most of them went to FAM. but it was like, oh, they could look up to someone. Plus, music was really heavily pushed because FAM has like they're known for their bands. And you had students playing all kind of instruments, including like classical type of instruments. And you know, that's the kind of exposure that they wouldn't have gotten elsewise, because once they integrated, like my mom is the only, she's the youngest, but out of the five, like she's the only member in her family who was not, did not learn how to play a musical instrument, and that's just because of integration. Once integration happened, those opportunities stopped. Plus, when my mom transferred, like I said, people weren't happy. So my mom was more so concerned about her safety and getting on the bus, because often when the kids were getting dismissed, the parents, the angry parents, would come behind them with knives and broken glass bottles. So playing instruments probably was like the last thing on her mind, but it's like one of her biggest regrets. She didn't get that experience. So that's Miss Sabora, and she's a baby boomer. I think I have Mr. Sandy Quinn Jr. next, I think. Nope, he likes smiling, just kidding, that's my uncle.
But what would you say to the millennial generation or generations that are coming up as far as advice?
So the first thing that I do want to ask you about, that you don't try to figure out what to take care of. Reach that goal, you work hard, and you push yourself. Know what the components are, what I call the success phase and all that encourage people to pursue. So once you identify your goal, what it is that you choose to go, then you try to figure out what does it take to get here? What's happening there, what it takes to reach where you choose to go.
Okay, so my uncle, he's actually my great uncle, but I just say uncle for short. It's my dad's uncle. So my uncle Elijah was actually my mom's classmate. I mean, just small world, right? Small town, small world. but he, you know, you hear these situations, the stories coming, like kids come from these like adverse living conditions, right? Like South Central Los Angeles, where it's like gang activity and, you know, up pops this person who like goes on to school and becomes like the next Ben Carson or something like that. And you're like, oh wow, that's amazing. Well, my parents may have not grown up in a gang violent kind of ordeal, but they grew up around a lot of violence just because of integration, okay? So my uncle Elijah, what his focus was is if I could just get out of here and get to college, I will be okay. My uncle Elijah has 5 degrees, okay? I will never be on his level, ever, ever, ever. Not trying to be. He is the first, he's the only black judge to come from Port St. Joe. He has a bachelor's in government from Florida State. He has his MBA, his CPA. Of course, he has his JD because he's a judge, and some other master's in something. Accounting. Well, no, accounting is CPA, but something else. But, and I was like, Uncle Elijah, because he started going to school, I think. So it was a couple of things, and this happened with Ms. Deborah too. People, some teachers kind of saw certain students and was like, okay, I'm going to take them up under my wing despite this whole race stuff. And they typically took the extremely athletic kids, or the extremely, what they call, smart kids. And my Uncle Elijah was able to get into a program where he could pretty much start college during his senior year. That's pretty much what happened. I mean, it had a different name for it. And so he started when he was 17 at Florida State, and he just never stopped going to school. And I was like, okay, so tell me, Uncle Elijah, how, you know, law ties in with accounting and business. And he goes in debt, and he's like, they're all tied together, and you know, he's like a very, he's an extremely humble guy. You would never know that he has all his degrees. I found that out actually just through interviewing him. I mean, he doesn't talk about, I mean, okay, it's on the internet, I just want to look for it, but I mean, he's not that person who's just like, look at me, you know, just list, you know, call me Judge Smiley when you talk to me, like, he's not like that. What I thought was also interesting is when I went to interview him, I interviewed him in his office, and I'm looking at the wall, and I believe, yes, I do recall, maybe there's another black person, but I believe he's the only black man that's up there on the pictures. And I'm like, okay, it's 2018. I was really impressed, though, to see Hispanic. I think it was like a Hispanic woman, a Hispanic man, black man on the legend. Okay, so it's a little diverse. Got a little splash in there. And my middle sister, the one who's Peace Corps, she wants to do international law, so maybe her picture will be up there one day. And she, still have him. They'll have no idea that they're related because her last name is Former and he's Smiley, so no one will get it but us. It'll just be an inside family thing. Great guy. He's, you know, always giving back to the community, and he knows who he is, and he's like a huge inspiration for me. I hope to be, you know, as half as successful and and as humble as he is. So that's his story. But he did say that, you know, when he did mention integrating, you know, wasn't the most pleasant experience, but he just focused on academics, and that was his motivation and his way out. But the other thing that I forgot to mention, Ty, and well, from his story or on forward, you'll hear people say the same thing. I didn't include it because everyone's saying the same thing. One of the advantages of growing up in a small town is it's still very much community-oriented, maybe not as community-oriented as it was before when my parents were growing up, but it's still, since the community is there, and they were like, yeah, you could play and roam the streets and you didn't have to worry about getting kidnapped, and I can attest to that. My parents never let me roam the streets, that's for sure. But, you know, when I was out of friends, they weren't, like, too worried. You know, they knew, like, if I went out to play at the park, they were there as well, but they kind of, like, hovered over me. But they knew it was Port St. Joe and that, you know, it's generally a very safe environment. So, and there, someone told a story about how, like, if there are families in need, someone was going hungry, no one went hungry. Even people who owned stores, like the sellers who owned the grocery store, they would loan food out, or, you know, people, you know, they could come in and work a day or something and pay it off. But they made sure at the end of the day that person had, they had three square meals a day. And so I thought that was pretty cool. All right, so I think Sandy Quinn Jr. is next.
It was a good experience, you know, like I said, I model myself, try to outdo what your parents did. Mm-hmm. You know, if your parents want to graduate from high school, then your goal should be to try to graduate from college. If your parents graduate with a BS degree, then your goal should be to try to graduate with your master's degree. You know, so I would say, give 110%. Sometimes how you act on the floor, you got to remember, people are watching you. Mm-hmm. They're always watching you. One day, you might need a favor. A lot of people that are watching, there might be somebody that can help you one day. So make sure you carry yourself. Make sure your character is intact. Make sure you always with integrity. Make sure you always be honest with people. And I don't mind going back for and say, you know what? She's a good person. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, man, Mr. Sandy Quinn Jr., love this guy. So he I just attracted a whole bunch of like soft-spoken, quiet people in this connection. But he's just like this little. He's a county commissioner for Port St. Joe, which is awesome. He's a young guy, has a lot of great ideas. I mean, well, he's Generation X, so I mean, I don't know what people would gauge, but I consider him still kind of be young. And I don't know if my opinion matters, but anyway. He. Definitely, obviously, a family man, but he, his story was, of course, I mean, it was the 80s. By the time, you know, he went to school, it was very much integrated. I think he graduated in 1992 from high school, so nothing like these other stories that we heard here. But he was saying, in his case, you know, he had some relatives that had went on to FAMU. Remember, I told you FAMU was, like, big in that area. Because that's where most of the teachers came from. And so I was like, well, how did you know that you're going to go to school? He's like, oh, I always knew. And he was like, I had no choice. My mom's like, you're going to school. And so, but because what I thought was interesting is you go back to Miss Cleo Best, and there is no opportunity for education. I mean, she's born in like 1916, okay? And it just was not going to happen unless, you know, yeah, just wasn't going to happen during that time period. But you see how people like Ms. Deborah go through the integration process, and some who went just graduate, like Ms. Kareen Peters. I mean, she went to school in New Jersey, so technically it wasn't segregated where she was, but they went through that process of enduring, you know, inequality and just getting through it and about their kids. And now you're seeing what's on the other end of going through and suffering and putting up with humiliating circumstances. But their kids now can benefit from that. So he's one of the kids that got to benefit from that. So he came in actually knowing someone from school, you know, who went to college. Whereas Ms. Peters her parents, you know, were immigrants. They didn't have the opportunity to go to school, you know? So you're seeing the connection there. And because of that, now he already knows, like, even if he didn't take high school, he took high school seriously, but he's like, you know, he could have studied harder. He didn't really learn his learning style until he got to college and had more one-on-one guidance. But the thought of college was already in him because of his environment. The environment changed. You know, went from, okay, the most I can do is clean people's houses and be a janitor to, no, school is actually a possibility. Like, school is actually the only one of the only options. Like, I'm going to have to go to school. So I like that. I like how that changed. I think next is Keon being there.
Keep going and helping people.
I feel like it's my purpose. God's plan for me. And I feel like I don't want to let people down by not being there when they need somebody to be there for.
Being from a small town like this,
what
was it prepared
you
for?
It made me very humble and gave me a way to definitely deal with people and being able to get to know people, because St. George is like family.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you bond with people a lot faster, getting to know other kids and everybody that you come in contact with, let them know it's some good people out there. Just let them buy into the dream of their dream and let them know that it's definitely achievable.
So you help others inspire their dreams. What is your dream for yourself?
Myself? Keep pushing kids off to college. I don't ask for much. I always like to see people make it. I always like to see them happy and being successful. And if I had a little bit to do.
And you're saying, if you have a little bit to do with that, then that makes his whole thing. So, another humble man. I'm just related to a lot of humble people in this. So, this is Keon McNair, who is Mr. Willie McNair's grandson. So, maybe a couple of his children did not go to college, but this guy went to college and just took things to a whole other level. Another humble person, this guy went to the Junior Olympics. Okay. He won 12 championship rings while in high school. So not only was he just academically brilliant, but he was also athletically just like really talented in multiple sports. And I mean, so I initially had this in the clip, I took it out, but I was like, so dude, what was it like going to the Junior Olympics coming from Fort St. Joe? And he was like, well, at the time, all I knew how to do was run, so I just ran. But he was like, but it was cool being around people from like all over the world and country, you know, and competing with them and having that opportunity as a teenager. And so, you know, he went on to a school in Central Florida and he got his degree in early childhood education. And, you know, he's obviously a very, you know, I'm not going to brag, but I mean, very nice looking, very talented guy, but he brought all that back to Fort St. Joe, and he's well traveled, went to Paris and everything. There's some pictures with him having Mona Lisa in the background. He did like a little selfie thing. He's part of Generation X, but he's on the border of Generation X and Millennial, so he has a little bit of both, but he took out all his experiences and he brought it back to his hometown of Fort St. Joe. So not only is he an educator, but he's a coach, and he has sent quite a few kids off to the Junior Olympics. He just took my grandmother's next door neighbors, so small it is, to the Junior Olympics last year in track. And he's just an amazing guy. He takes a lot of kids up under their wings. Some of the people that he was posing with that went to, that are in the high school, they got offered multiple scholarships, both academic and athletic. And so they have their choice of where they're going to school. And, and I was just asking, like, I mean, he's young and, you know, he still has, you know, he wants to establish a family and all that other stuff. So I'm like, well, what is it that, you know, you've done so much for so many people, what is it that, that's where that question came from, like, what is it that makes you happy or what would make you happy? And that's when he's like, oh, I'll just continue helping other people out and inspiring them. That would just, you know, if I can change someone's life, it sounds like you should be like, I don't know, like Obama Jr. or something. But he's also very soft-spoken, very sweet guy. And if you ever have a chance to go to Port St. Joe, you'll probably see him.
I'm going to tell you that I worked with him in a special needs classroom in Port St. Joe about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was so impressed. So I'm so glad to
see yeah.
where he's gone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, thanks. Thanks for, yeah. I'll definitely pass on the message. He's a great guy. Yeah.
How old is he?
So, he probably doesn't look his age, but he's going to be, he just turned 40. Yeah. So, yeah. He's still, I think he's, I don't know if he plans to, I know he plans to travel more eventually. He really enjoyed his Paris experience, so. And he's a, I don't know if people like believe in, you know, zodiac signs or not, but he's a Capricorn, so all he does is work. And literally, some family members, it's really strange, but somehow, some way, he's related to the Boris Starworth. Like, we are literally all related, okay? And so his cousin, Mitch DeBoer, was like, no, you need to go treat yourself and take a real vacation, not a working vacation. No, you're going to Paris, and guess what? You're not going to be able to do any, like, work from there. So. He spent like a month, I think, in Paris and enjoyed himself. So that's his story. I think next up is Montez.
What did you major in, or what did you graduate degrees in Chicago?
At an AA, and I got business management was my major in my heart.
And so what really, I think you told me you wanted to be a dancer since you were a kid. What was it that inspired you, and who were some of your favorite dancers?
What inspired me, it's kind of funny, I was watching the movie Glover, it's all around the show, and I seen Lorgan dancing, and that's what we really fall in love with dancing, like Earth of Care, and Lady Name the team, she used to be Alita's big choreographer. And then just falling in love with Abby Haley. That was just the icing on the cake. But just like seeing the passion that they had in their face with their whole body, it was just something that I always loved ever since I was a little kid, just to watch. And to go back and forth.
Okay, so Montez Walker, I'm not related to him, ironically, which I love. He's an awesome person. So he's more so on the cusp of being a millennial and Generation X. I think he's like 22 or something like that. But he just knew as a kid, like as I knew, like when I was 4, I wanted to be a doctor, and because I was looking through my mom's like anatomy books. When he was like a really small kid, he knew he wanted to be a dancer, and he said, ironically, the only way his mom could like get him to fall asleep was through like playing music or letting him watch like dancers on stage on some type of program, and he'll fall asleep to that. So it's just in his blood. And so, for Gator fans, you probably hate him, but he did graduate from FSU, just like my Blue Legend. But he doubled. He did business and dance as a minor, and he has had the opportunity to travel as well and dance with different companies. And I think he has a company that he's established in Panama City, or that he works with, pretty much sure it's one or the other, and he has a company in Atlanta that he works closely with. And what I do like about him, he's really young, and once again, he brought all that talent to Port St. Joe. So what he does, in addition to working with these other companies that you know may not be in Port St. Joe, he teaches dance at his church. My mind is not blank on the name of the church, but there's we have a lot of nicknames in Port St. Joe, so I don't want to say his name is not. We call him Cookie Jenkins, but that is not his name. Yes, New Life, yes, Shirley Jenkins, yes, thank you. Johnny, yes, oh my god, because I was like, I'm going to disrespect this man by calling him by his nickname. I mean, everyone has a nickname there, except for me. My name was like too long to come up with a nickname for that. But yeah, so he does that, and he was awesome at the exhibit. He gave like a brief performance, and I mean, he's just amazing. Really great guy. He's going to be working with me on some other future projects. But the key thing with him is that, you know, he brought his talent home, and he's, you know, through that, he's exposing other kids to go on and do the same thing. Because one thing that I've learned is, I was blessed where I have a very supportive family, but I also have a lot of mentors. And if it weren't for my family support and my mentors, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be where I am now. And a lot of times what people just need is exposure, no matter what their background is. You know, exposure does a lot for people. And so I'm so glad that Keon and Mr. Sandy Quinn Jr. are doing things like, and Mr. Gore, okay, everybody on there that I just mentioned, even Mr. Willie McNair, who still fusses at his kids for not going to college, too that they go to college, they're still in some form of, you know, giving back to the community or encouraging people to go to school. So I'm glad that I went to school and I was able to tell Mr. McNair that, because he probably gave me a lecture on that too. So the next person, and this is the last person, did Toby get included in there? Oops.
What's that?
I think I included, that's fine.
Precious.
Oh, Precious is coming up next, okay. So that's my cousin Toby, I'll tell you about him later, but, he's talking about, he's gonna go into journalism, and, he really wants to go to family. This is actually Sandy Quinn's Jr.'s cousin. He's saying the last name, but he's also my cousin too. Isn't that great? But this is Precious, the youngest. She's 12. And I just thought her story was really cute.
Precious. So, what are some of the things that you like to do at school?
Well, I love to do my little lab stuff, science, and reading. I just love reading.
What kind of books do you like to read?
Just really fiction books. Those are my favorite. And I'm just really creative.
Yeah, you draw, right? What are the things that you like to draw?
I draw huskies, mostly flowers, and sometimes I do different designs.
Very nice. And how long have you been drawing?
She's an inspiring artist, and we actually took some of her artwork and displayed it at the exhibit at Fort St. Joe, and she stood by it, and she's so proud, and, you know, I just want, it's kind of weird to say I mentored my own cousin, but, I mean, there's a lot of kids that I have mentored over my life and that I continue, and she's one of them. I just want her to, you know, not lose sight of the bigger picture, that there's a bigger world out there, there's plenty of opportunities, and not to let, you know, just being in a small town, even though it's great, but that's not all that there is. And there's wonderful things that she can do outside of that. So I wanted to give her exposure as early as possible, and I thought it was appropriate in letting her have her artwork displayed, even if she wasn't gonna really sell it, but that she can get that experience. So when she does decide to become an artist and she's successful, she can say, oh yeah, you know, I showed off my stuff at the art gallery, and I was like, you know, 12, you know, hundreds of people came and looked at it, so yeah, I'm pretty special. So that's her story. And I think what I saw when I looked from the interviews from Miss Cleo all the way down to Precious, from Silent GI Generation to Generation Z,
is I saw a lot of hope, ironically. I mean, people probably like, what do you get hope from? They're talking about KKK and, you know, stuff that's going on now. But, you know, it's like, I don't necessarily agree with what people have to go through. I don't agree with what I've had to go through, what, you know, to get here. And I do think it's unfair that there are people out there that, you know, have biases and, you know, have, you know, maybe hate in their heart or whatever. But I see my cousin Precious, and, you know, even just hearing this Cleo Vest, after all that she went through, and she still had this message of love despite all of that, that's a lot. Like, I think sometimes people underestimate that. You know, they're always like, oh, Martin Luther King had a dream and he was just all happy. That dude was like in prison, he was beat down. Like, it's a really hard place to come from, like, love out of all that stuff. Like, a lot of the civil rights leaders endured, you know, anyone who stood up for the underdog or tried to make things better endured a lot of stuff. And to come out on the other side of that with that kind of attitude. But a little humor to add to the cuteness of her video. So, as I mentioned before, that my great-grandmother is half white, and that's just on my mom's side. I mean, there's white people on my dad's side too. It's just people everywhere. We're just all mixed up as in the race. But my boyfriend is white, and no one ever thought about the fact that we could possibly be related. I mean, he's from South Florida. I mean, you know, where are the odds? But his granddad definitely made it known that he doesn't like black people. He said I would never be welcome in his house. He has changed that sentiment over time, but I mean, it is what it is. But his granddad took this DNA test to prove his whiteness. He's one of those kind of people, okay? Where we'd be like, yeah, I got this Irish, Italian, blah, blah, English. And it came back with him being the fourth black. So, ironically, when I met my boyfriend, Kyle, and he was like, oh, yeah, I got Portuguese, I got black in me, too. And I'm like, okay. He's like, let's not go that far. Just saying. So, yes, that's my story. That's the Report St. Joe's story. It's, you know, very diverse. These DVDs are actually put together, the interview itself and the pictures. Oh, yeah, so the reason why people didn't want to be filmed. Okay, you know, so we have the history of what happened, people coming through, marching with sheets. Some of these people, including my papa, who I didn't even show his clip, worked for paper mill and stuff, they had fear that some of the stories that they were telling would be, you know, found out. So I just kept it, like, I was like, you know, just go ahead, submit pictures, you don't have to do an actual visual one. Their stories are still being told. But anyway, my sister, who graduated, I have her SCAD cup here, she went to graduate from Savannah College of Art and Design. She is a motion media graphics major and has the New Georgia Dome. If you ever go to Atlanta, she has a huge tribute to it on the wall. She was involved with the design of that. She's just, both of my sisters are doing awesome things. I'm very proud of them. She put that together. And so we do have some of those available for a small donation of like $10 just because of like shipping and handling. She had to pay for all that. But it's a great just piece of history to have, even if you're not related to any of these people. And I just think having Miss Cleo Vest's story, it's just really awesome. I mean, she actually had planned to be there for opening night of the exhibit and was not able to make it, but her story lives on.
There's the opening clip.
Yes, there's the opening, and there's music, and it's separated by generations. So for every generation, they're grouped into four, and it'll say, okay, this group, generation S, you know, whatever. So you can keep up that way. But yes, I think my sister did a great job, and I'm not trying to toot her horn, but I am. I'm a proud big sister. But yeah, if you like those, you can talk to me. Those are available. Other than that, thank you for coming.
I had a question.
Sure.
During your research, did you come across the reference to the Green Book, which was used by black people that were traveling because
yes.
they weren't allowed to stay in the hotels that were, you know, in segregated areas?
Yes, there is a Green Book. I don't know if you guys are aware. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of the document that was, we weren't allowed to travel. And so that's what kind of was really interesting to me for Mr. McNair's story is that, you know, his dad didn't need the Green Book, but because of his whiteness, he just forgot that his son would. So that's probably why they had so many bad encounters, because he just didn't, I mean, he came from California, he didn't even think about that. That was something that he would actually need in order for his son to be able to stay in a hotel with him, or go to a store, his own son.